Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Jackie Mitchell. This is where we pick the best brains in the business world and you, the listener, feel like you are eavesdropping on a really interesting coffee conversation to give you and your business the inside edge. We take a look into the business mindsets of leaders and brands and probe into how they think, feel, learn, manage teams and themselves. We love sharing the knowledge and serve brain food to keep your business mind healthy. To continue the conversation, you can connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. So, while our first guest settles in, orders their coffee, grab yourself one, and we'll be right back after this. Welcome back. Our next guest is an expert in career development, talent management, and organisational leadership. He is the co-founder of HR consulting firm Deliberate Practice, and he helps aspiring, emerging, and experienced leaders to develop their everyday skill set. And he's just written his first book titled Career Conversations, How to Get the Best from Your Talent Pool. Welcome to the show, Greg Smith.
Thank you very much, Jackie.
Good to have you here. Your first book, congratulations. It's always quite an achievement, that first one.
It is, thank you.
Was the process easy, hard? What was it for you?
Well, it took 2 years, and I Googled how to write a book.
Oh, really?
oddly enough, it said expect it to take 2 years, and from the day I started writing it to the day it was published was exactly 2 years. So it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience.
Oh, that's good. Did you have some guidance? Did you get some mentor or some advice along the way?
Not really. I just, as I said, looked at what was available on the internet on how to write a book, and I had this idea for this particular book gestating for quite some time before I put pen to paper. But largely just got on with doing it, which was pretty much what the advice was that I was given.
Okay.
And start writing.
Okay. Yeah. Did you have a process? Like, did you say, right, I'm going to write for 30 minutes every day, or did you go for 3 hour blocks?
Yeah, I tried to do a word count every day, but there were some days that I didn't make it at all, and other days where the words just flowed. But I'd have to say also my publisher John Wiley was just terrific in guiding me, particularly with the finished work through to making sure that it was actually achieving my objectives and structurally was correct, and of course the expression. So, but I can't speak enough for John Wiley and the whole team there in terms of helping me.
Yeah, well, they're consistently good. So I think you've chosen well there. Now, yeah. I enjoyed it very much. I found it really easy to read. And there was a couple of elements there in it that I found particularly attractive. And one, it was chapter 3, Fit Your Own Mask First. And you use an Oscar Wilde quote, which I do like this one, be yourself, everyone else is taken. So can you just tell us a little bit about what you mean by fit your own mask first?
Sure. Well, like with any leadership activity, there's a lot that's spoken about being comfortable in your own skin to be a great leader. And that's so true for being a career coaching leader. So to be able to help other people and help them with their own self-awareness, you really need to be pretty in touch with your own capabilities and attributes and values, and in that way then you can help others do that. So that's why I had that idea of fit your own mask first, before you start trying to help other people.
Yeah, and I think that's somehow overlooked a lot. Have you had is that your experience?
Yeah, surprisingly, the work that I've been involved in with very, very senior leaders who find starting from that position of actually having a good look at their own capabilities and attributes and competencies and values, that they find it quite a cathartic experience and thinking, gee, I've often had it said, again, by senior leaders, how enlightening they've found it and they wish they'd done it a number of years earlier.
Yeah, I think that's really key. And you talk about listening, and there was one heading that you had that really took my attention, and I loved it. It was persuade with your ears. I had never heard that before, and I thought that was wonderful. So tell us a little bit what you meant by that.
Well, I think if you know, listening is one of those skills that you never stop learning to develop, and that's why I don't like attaching a rating to it in terms of how good is your listening skills, because I think if you know wherever you rate yourself, you know, if you said rating yourself 4 out of 5, you think, well, I'm nearly as good as I can be. But I think I'm not a fan of that, because I don't think you ever should stop developing that skill. It should be a lifelong journey, no matter how good you are now. I think if there was something that you could take away from even today's conversation, Jackie, it would be just that. You know, really focus on developing your listening skills. And I've got a saying that you don't know the question you've asked till you've actually heard the answer to it. And I think that's so true. And I think if you can have your radar up and listen with more than your ears, so you know, watching for people's animation and their body language and their tone of voice, et cetera, are all important signals in terms of what they may be trying to convey to you more than the actual words they use.
Yeah, that's a great insight. The other area, and I suppose I had a personal interest in this, or a professional interest, was about what's your personal brand. Mm. So just tell us a little bit about how important a personal brand is, not so much for a entrepreneur, but an employee. So why is it important for an employee to have a personal brand?
Well, it's really, really quite critical. And the reality is everyone's got a personal brand. They may not even know what it, they may not know that, but they actually do have a personal brand. And so it's a way of expressing what you stand for. And that goes right to your values, most importantly. And the applications for it nowadays is particularly in social media, like LinkedIn, for instance, as a professional network. Mm. It's really critical that you manage your own brand and make sure that the perceptions are matching reality. And the best way to do that is to take charge of it yourself and not let others craft it for you, but actually craft your own brand, because it's going to effectively be what you stand for, and that will impact on what potential employers may see in you, or perhaps potential clients of your business may see in you. So it's a really, really critical aspect to develop and cultivate. And we're very familiar with product brands, but when it comes to our own personal brands, we don't pay, or sometimes we don't pay as much attention to it as we should.
Yeah, default or design. People will come up with that either way. So design's
right.
Always going to be the preferable route, I'd say.
Yeah.
And also with employees, if you're looking at if you're ambitious within an organisation, or just wanting to get noticed, or wanting to sort of get out there, sometimes your own perception of yourself can be quite different from how others see you. So how would you advise an employee to get feedback from how other people perceive you?
Well, there's some really, really standard ways of doing that. If you're a leader now, you've probably had a 360 done, or maybe you haven't, but that's a great place to start,
yep.
Having a 360-degree survey conducted. And, you know, your organisation may routinely do that already. But if they don't, I'd perhaps suggest doing that is a great way to do that. And also just talking to other people, just ask them, what are your perceptions? And looking at what people write about you and what they post on social media, for instance, and other valuable sources. But in a leadership context, certainly a 360-degree feedback survey is a great way to get some very direct and objective feedback.
Yeah, another idea I suggest is, you mentioned LinkedIn, is to ask for testimonials and then start looking at the particularly the verbs or adjectives that people are using to describe you, and start looking for some common threads, and that might then give you an insight into it as well.
That's a terrific idea, Jackie.
Yeah. So speaking of LinkedIn, Greg, I noticed there, and it's always been a topic of interest for me, and I can never, I always have this disagreement with a number of LinkedIn experts that can never agree. Do you write your LinkedIn profile in the first person, or do you write it in the third person? What's your view?
Well, my view is to write in the first person, unlike perhaps a resume, for instance, which I'm not a fan of writing in the first person. But in a LinkedIn profile is really, really important, And it's a way of you actually expressing or letting the readers know what you're really all about and letting them get to know you a little bit. So a resume is more of a statement about your capabilities and where you're targeting your career and what have you. And a LinkedIn profile is that as well. But it's actually, I think it's an opportunity to be far more personal about what you believe in and I'd put in my LinkedIn profile that careers and leadership fascinate me, for instance. And I probably wouldn't write that in a resume, for instance, where I'm talking more to capability. Mm. But I would definitely, my preference is first person, and let the write in a way that readers can actually get to know you as a person.
Yeah, I might need to go back and revisit because I had it in first person, then LinkedIn experts said, oh, you've got to write in third person, Jackie. So I did that. I might need to go back and revisit. But I think that's the message there, is not just to write it and leave it, is to keep it up to date and revisit it, refresh it.
Yeah, I think some people make the mistake of just somehow doing a cut and paste from their resume into their LinkedIn profile, mm. which I definitely wouldn't recommend.
No.
So coming back to your point about personal branding, it's a really powerful way to personally brand yourself. Perhaps have a look at my LinkedIn profile and you'll get a bit of an idea of what I think about it. But it's a really powerful branding tool.
And now part of your book you mentioned, I'm a big fan of his work, Malcolm Gladwell, and
yep.
you mentioned his work on the tipping point. Just quickly tell us about that.
Yeah, well, tipping point was written a number of years ago now, but I think it's still really current. It's often quoted. You'll hear it being quoted in all sorts of different forums now. As the so-called tipping point, but it was coined by Malcolm Gladwell, and he spoke about it in his book of the same name as a way, at the point at which something becomes an epidemic. And he spoke about it in terms of health epidemics or in terms of or fads that took off. For instance, he gave an example of hush puppies, which many of your listeners may not even remember, but they were down to apparently their last 30,000 pairs. And a small cult group in Greenwich Village happened to adopt them, and suddenly the whole brand took off again globally. And it's and he picked up on these themes and patterns that would occur and reach this so-called tipping point where it would really accelerate. And in an organisational context, I'd often think about it as a way to get a ripple through an organisation. So particularly in a low energy way, but getting the ripple through the organisation of what you're trying to develop, and therefore hit that so-called tipping point. He also spoke about the rule of 150, where he said it was really hard to manage organisations over 150 people before you had to start putting managers in who would then filter the information from the organisation. So, and he spoke about a private organisation that built factories within close proximity to each other, with only 150 car spaces. And when the owner of the factory was asked, "Well, how do you know when it's time to build new factories?" They say, "Well, when people stop parking on the grass, when they start parking on the grass." But it's a terrific. I think it's about 200 pages, and nowhere there he talks about systems theory, but that's effectively what it's all about.
Yeah, he's got another Blink. Have you read Blink?
Yes, I have, yeah.
Yeah,
terrific book.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. All his work is really great.
But highly recommend it. The tipping point, despite its age, I would highly recommend your readers. It's an enjoyable reading, even if you've got no interest in the subject at all.
Yeah.
It's just an enjoyable couple of hundred pages.
Well, it's a bit like Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. That's still relevant. It's probably more relevant than when he wrote it. So,
yes, indeed.
It's all interesting stuff. And your book, we better get back to your book, Career Conversations, Greg Smith, How to Get the Best from Your Talent Pool. Really enjoyed it. Those that want to find out a bit more about you and find where to get the book, they can find you at deliberatepractice.com.au, and I believe that you hang around on Twitter and also, of course, your LinkedIn. You've got to look at your LinkedIn page. Tremendous. Thank you, Greg Smith, for your time today.
Thanks so much, Jackie.
Thank you. We hope you're enjoying eavesdropping on these interesting conversations. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Our next guest is a transformational coach, leadership development for organisational culture, an executive change manager and author. He is director of Corporate Alchemy. Welcome, Peter Shields.
Hello, welcome. Oh, thank you, Jackie.
Thank you. Welcome to me too. That's very nice of you. Thank you. Now, I have been reading your book, and I'm going to start straight off the bat. It's called Leadership Alchemy, and I like the fact that it's a, like the brand connection with your business, Corporate Alchemy. So tell us a little bit about Corporate Alchemy before we start talking about your book.
So I work as your intro suggested, helping leaders understand their own beliefs and assumptions and transforming them to something more effective for individual and then extended to the collective leadership so businesses can nail their purpose and vision.
So how do you define transformational leadership?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. There's, most of us are set up to be good at leadership or good at management, and I do love that old leadership book, Good to Great, and the author there, Jim Collins, identified the difference. So I sort of help leaders identify what do they see as great leadership and allow them to set the transformational agenda based on their perspective. I've learned over the years that the ego is a really resistant and powerfully resourced defense mechanism. So now I help them and their team identify what is great leadership and then assist them to transform from where they are to where they say they want to be.
Yes, I noticed in reading your book, and I'm halfway through and I'm absolutely hooked. And I read a lot of business books. I try to also read some fiction to balance out my creative and my brain just to give it a bit of a rest. But I do get sent a lot of business books. And sadly, I get a bit upset when it's sort of the same thing over and over and over again. And so I'm always looking for that little bit different, some different thinking, some real thought leadership. And then I came across your book, and I must admit it sat there on the shelf for a while because it's quite thick. It's got 400 pages, and most sort of business books are about, you know, 100, 200 or something like that, or less, with lots of pictures. And I've gone, I've had a quick flick through your book, and there's no pictures in there. There's no flow charts. There's no matrix. And then I'm thinking, what's going on here? And then I realise it's a novel. And you've actually, and it's incredible, Peter. I'm really impressed. You've actually made a business book into a novel, much like historical fiction does. So I love historical fiction whereby it's based on the reality of Henry VIII or something, and then someone like a Philippa Gregory will write it in the first person from one of his wives and then fills in the gaps of what life might have been like. And so you're learning history, but you're learning it in the, you know, tried and true way of storytelling. So you've used the power of storytelling to teach about leadership and to teach about business. And I just think it's wonderful. Congratulations. And how did you come up with that idea to actually make it into a story?
I like you, am a little tired of case study driven academic or sort of dogmatic style leadership books. I read them, I get across them. And I wanted to bring adult development theory to life. I'm a big fan of Keegan and Leahy's research and how that relates to leadership. So I wanted to bring it to life with story and see myself as a bit of a translator. I'm across the academic. I'm not an academic, but I do leverage their perspective to reference my own thoughts. So, yeah, I just wanted to bring it to life, especially for men who might be in their mid-40s, might be coming into the prime of their leadership career, but have an absence of role models to remember from the 80s and 90s that would be relevant for modern leadership. So much has changed. And, yeah, I really wanted men to understand that. And I also wanted younger, diverse perspectives on leadership. The obvious one being from females, I wanted them also to have a bit of a role model for how to navigate the old bureaucratic and the old hierarchical systems that arguably are set up to help them fail. So I wanted to help men, and I wanted to help younger leaders who are thinking differently, especially for young women.
Yeah, well, I think you've done that balanced. You've really balanced that perfectly. I read that, and I quite often it's very sort of male dominated, but the reality is a lot of business is male dominated. So there's that balance of we need to introduce more female role models for more female leaders, but we also need to keep it real. So there's that reality versus aspiration. And then you also want to bring the young people up, that then people that are older, so they've still got value. Just because you turn 65 or 70, you then go, well, we'll throw you on the scrap heap.
Right.
That's such a waste as well. And I think you've balanced that really well. And your first, the first line or the first paragraph of the book, I'm going to read this out just to tease everyone, because this first paragraph, I thought you're obviously a natural storyteller. It says here, this is the first bit. I've always been in control. This is from your character, Ben, who's 82. He was the CEO and founder of a big company. He says, I've always been in control. I've always found a solution to every problem. But now I feel like an uprooted weed torn from the garden of life, abandoned on the lawn, awaiting death by mower. I thought that was a lovely way to start, and that's a real issue. Have you always liked writing stories? It's from school. Did you like reading and writing?
I love historical fictions as well, and especially if they have a frivolous side and a bit of... I love the license to be able to write fiction. I've written three books before. This is the first I've published, and... Yeah, so I've always loved storytelling. I sadly flunked English and went down to what we used to call in the old days, veggie English, just to hang out with my cousin. I sort of wish I went on and studied three-unit English and actually understood more about it. But maybe it's time to learn that now.
Well, look, I certainly will encourage you to do that, Peter. I think this has absolutely filled a gap, and that's the marketer in me. I got very excited about the concept, but then I started really enjoying the story. As I said, I'm halfway through, so I'm looking forward to see what happens. But I have to ask you about the characters, and I'm speaking to a lot of authors. So did you model these characters on anything about yourself or people that you know?
Yes, so I'm trained in creativity psychotherapy, which is a Jungian approach to psychology and all about drama and theatre. And I learned there about the idea that we all have 16 archetypes, and each of these characters is an archetype representative of my inner fears and angst and issues, and also my idealised, objective and better integrated characters and feminine side. So yeah, they're all a part of me, terrifyingly enough.
Well, I noticed that you've got a background in psychology, but also that you refer to neuroscience, and neuroscience is one of my keen areas, particularly neuromarketing. And one of the foundations of neuromarketing is the concept of similarity, that if people can see something similar in another person, it helps them improve communication and likability and things like that. And as I was reading this, some of these things have happened to me. I'm reading them going, when Angela was in the boardroom and she's having that boardroom conversation, I've had that conversation. That's happened. I didn't perform as well as she did in the book, but I could relate to that. And there was so much in there, all the issues, because she's the coach. Ben's the business owner. Angela's the business coach and his advisor and confidant. But even to have someone like that around, and I just like the way that you've actually built that that story around. But the bit that I was most interested in was about this shadow aspects, which you just touched on then. This shadow aspects of leadership psychology. Just tell us a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, that's a Carl Jung idea who popularised the concept of we all have a ego, which is an identity, and we all have an ego shadow, that which I have disowned about myself. And therefore don't see in myself. And the curious thing about it, though, is I start to see the issue with others. And this is called the projection of the shadow. The line that lands at best for me, Jackie, is that as I look out, I don't see people in the world. I see myself projected onto people in the world. And I find that as a deliciously dangerous concept for my self-awareness, especially if in service of an organizational goal, and especially if I'm overwhelmed and stressed. It's a really powerful way to help leaders take self-awareness to another level and consider that the things that frustrate them about others and the system and the government and the industry, et cetera, could potentially just be something that they've carried into the room.
Look, there's so much. I think there's a whole other conversation here, Peter, so I might have to get you back. But there's another paragraph I'm going to read out, which I thought was, again, such a great insight into humanity, into human behaviour. And you said, it says here, I'm just trying to think who said it. Was it Angela or Ben? I think it might be Angela. But anyway, it's the concept here is being human is nature's joke on us. She has given us the most complex phenomenon that ever existed, human emotion. It's the window to experience of all nature's paradoxical forces. And to top it off, we were also given an awareness device, the mind, with which to observe it. And then that is so good, because that observation, interestingly, is where leads lots of opportunity, but also leads a lot of problems. So you've got that, the dark side and the light side, and there's the shadow and the light, and trying to find that balance between it.
Wow, thank you for picking up on that. And I'm sometimes jealous of the reptiles and arguably the lesser mammals. And the birds, they just operate in the fight, flight, freeze response, and yet we have all of that complexity, and then on top of that, the neocortex to assess and to judge, and then all feelings in the middle. It's a wonderful burden to be alive with. And now with the internet and then the social media, we've got access to everything everyone else is doing and thinking and aware of. I find it really humbling to slow down and see and experience that.
That's a good point. It's funny you talk about the jealous animals. I look at my dogs all the time and think, I want to come back as them. I want to be one of my dogs.
Oh, to be a lapdog.
Yes. I mean, just that whole, you know, how excited they get when they get their meals every day. And I must admit, it grounds me a little bit when I'm feeling overwhelmed or stressed. And I look at them and think, God, just stop for a minute, Jackie, and really take in what's happening right now. I suppose it's that Eckhart Tolle philosophy of the power of now. Stop and stop thinking so far ahead and stop looking back. But, you know, look, it's a constant struggle. But I think we're getting better at it with people like you around, these books being written, social media, if there's some good messaging going out there, and also the latest evidence-based findings in neuroscience. They're finding more about the brain now than they've ever had. So hopefully that will lead us to greater growth and not greater destruction.
Right, yes, there's so many amazing positive things happening, and curiously, and it's been history holds this as evidence that the media and likes to leverage all the negative, but boy, there's so many wonderful things going on, even though governments might be trying to hang on to the old ways. Industry, creative leaders, young leaders, social media is helping. Yeah, it's a really exciting time.
Yeah, it is. It's very challenging. Well, Peter Shields, it's been a delight talking to you. Congratulations on your book, The Leadership Alchemy. I'm assuming it's available where you can buy books.
It is. And, your bookstore, if it doesn't have it, they can order it and you can buy it online as well.
Excellent. And if people want to find out a bit more about you, they can connect with you on which platforms?
LinkedIn. I'm not really into the Facebook thing right now, but LinkedIn definitely I'm available. But also my website is an easy way to connect with me and have conversations.
Okay, your website is
www.corporatealchemy.com.au. Alchemy, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y.
CorporateAlchemy.com.au. Peter Shields, thank you very much for your valuable time today. Really enjoyed it. And thank you for being part of Taking Care of Business.
My pleasure, Jackie. Thank you so much. And have a wonderful week.
Yeah, I will. I love sharing the knowledge right here on Taking Care of Business on Adult PFM. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Taking Care of Business. Our next guest is a global thought leader in commercial strategy, and she's one half of the strategic and creative team behind the most successful new product launch in Australian history. Wow. She has helped entrepreneurs build internationally successful businesses and work with some of the world's most influential organisations. What a CV, what an intro. I'm really excited and looking forward to having a chat with and welcoming Kieran Flanagan.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Now, I have to ask the first question that you're involved with, the successful new product launch in Australian history. What was that?
I know, it's very mysterious, isn't it?
It is.
Without telling you what it was.
I know.
It was Coke Zero.
It was Coke Zero, right.
Yes, most successful new product launch in history, in Australian history. They sold their annual projection within, I think, 2 or 3 months. And it had actually failed in the US and in Canada prior to launching in Australia, and they almost didn't launch it here. It was such a dismal failure in the other countries. So we were third to go, and luckily enough, we did something completely different to the other countries. And anyway, it launched here and was very successful, and they then took that strategy back around the world to launch in the other countries successfully.
So what did you do differently?
Do you know what? Oh, it's quite a lot of things. Initially, the American marketers had essentially made it a bit of a Diet Coke, so it still had quite a female target. Then we went for a male target. The can was black here. The can was white in other markets. So it was very different. It was aimed at men. It had a very different tone to Diet Coke. So that's what made it successful, taking a very masculine approach and saying men want to have a no-sugar drink as well. Even though women can drink it too, of course, but
yeah.
Men tend to not drink a product aimed at women, whereas women are quite happy to drink products aimed at men.
Right, and having to work with a iconic brand like Coca-Cola, you know, when in brand and advertising world, it's always one of the sort of top three brands that, particularly as you're starting out, I hope I get to work for a Coca-Cola. What was it like working from them from a brand perspective and having them as a client?
Look, you know, we had the privilege of working with them for 10, 15 years. We worked with them for a really long time on many of their launches and brands. And you know, what's amazing, I think, about Coke as a business is they retain a level of ambition that you might think would disappear over time. So, you know, there was never a thought that you could grow more or do more or build deeper connections with customers. They were always looking to improve, and I think that is an extraordinary lesson for businesses, big and small, is even the largest businesses on the planet don't stop looking for growth and looking for how they could do better.
Yeah. We might just stop there for a minute.
Was that car noisy?
No, it was the mobile phone connection dropped out.
Oh.
Yeah, it
I
sort
haven't
of
moved.
Went in and out. Yeah, so I'm just checking. Yeah, could we get that last answer again?
Sure, of course.
I can't remember what I asked you now. What did I ask
you? Asked me, what was it like working with Coke?
Oh, yeah, I'll do that. Okay. All right.
So you just want me to answer?
Yeah, okay, yeah, if you can just answer it, that'd be great. Thank you.
That's all right. Look, I worked with Coca-Cola for 10 to 15 years, I can't remember exactly, and it was just an absolute privilege. And I think one of the most amazing things about working with a company like Coke is that no matter their scale, is that they were always incredibly ambitious. They were always looking at how can we do something better, how can we improve at what we offer, how can we connect better with our customers. And I think every day you show up to work with them and be looking to answer those questions. They're always looking for growth and improvement. And I think that's a really good lesson. It doesn't matter how big or small our businesses are, we should always be looking to do stuff better. I think that probably for me was one of the best things about working with them.
Yeah, success leaves clues, doesn't it? And that's certainly one that anyone listening now from an entrepreneur, small business owner, working corporately can certainly take out of it. And that's great. Thanks for sharing that story. I knew there was going to be a good story, Kieran, behind that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Now, the next bit of the story is that you have written a book called Forever Skills, the 12 Skills to Future-Proof Yourself, Your Team and Your Kids. And you've done that with Dan Gregory. And anyone listening, and a lot of our listeners are great fans of the Gruen Transfer, and they will know Dan Gregory from the Gruen Transfer. How did you and Dan co-author this? So did you work together?
Yes, we're business partners. We have a business together, and we've worked together for just over 25 years
now. Wow.
Yeah, I know, really long partnership.
Brilliant.
So he said he will have to have me killed if I ever try to leave that work partnership. We're not married because I know too much.
I love that. So is this your first book?
Not literally have me killed, but, you know.
I know, figuratively, yeah. So is this your first book?
No, we've written, this is our third book, but
right.
So we co-author most of our stuff together, and which I think is really nice to have, again, a partnership model to make sure the thinking is rigorous. And we interviewed a lot of people for this book, so sometimes I feel a bit bad because there's a whole lot of collective wisdom in there. So our names go on the cover, but there's an awful lot of clever people's knowledge and wisdom in that book.
Yeah, well, I was pleased to see some research based. How many people did you interview? How many hundreds?
Hundreds.
Hundreds.
So some, you know, in different ways. Sometimes it was audience polls and questions given to, you know, 500 people at a time, surveys. Some of it was, you know, face-to-face interviews we've been doing for years. Some of them we didn't, you know, we had stories that we'd gathered from conversations from the past decade or so, really, that it's all melded together into this book.
And so you've said here the 12 skills. I have to ask, why 12?
It's an excellent question. Look, to be honest, there could be more than 12, but for the ability for people to hold and transmit and learn from them, yeah, 12 is a good number for human beings. It's empirical. You know, we're used to operating in 12. So we decided to limit ourselves to 12. But look, people will find the concept of forever skills, they will be able to look and see more in their own world. And some of them we've collapsed into others, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
But otherwise, we could have gone on forever.
Yeah, I know. And then you probably put people off completely because it would just be too overwhelming. But I do like the fact that you've combined future-proof yourself, your team, and your kids. And I like the fact that you've combined work and home together, this sort of balanced, you know, it should be blended now. It needs to be, which is always one of my things about, it's all about blended workplace, you know, family life, work life, social life. It's all your life. It's one life and about sort of blending it all together. So was that the sort of premise of including the home life in that?
Well, yeah, I mean, for us, we think the work-life divide is an artificial divide that potentially served us once upon a time. But, as our digital devices and our home lives come together, I agree that we blend them.
Mm.
And the book's got an unusual, I guess, frame in it, and we speak a lot to people in companies, but, you know, their parents. So a lot of the conversations are about the business or the, you know, the small business or the large big corporate business, but it's also about education and their children. And the conversations are the same. You know, what are we going to do? We're in panic. We're facing this tsunami of change. We're afraid. We're reacting really quickly. And we just wanted to put a book into the marketplace and, more importantly, an idea into people's heads that change isn't as singular as most people see it. So most people take a very myopic view of change. We obsess about what's changing. And in the book, we share a model that we use all the time with people that makes change easier, which is a three-prong model. So what's changing, what needs changing, where you proactively change things. Entrepreneurs spend a lot of time there. And what's unchanging. And the book's really focused on what's the unchanging stuff. What won't go away? You know, we can't completely control change, but we can certainly look at it from those three facets, and when we see it in its entirety, we take the panic out of it and make better decisions.
Yeah, I like that. Focus on the things that won't change within us. I think that's a really, really useful useful element in that whole book. I enjoyed that very much. Kieran, what do you think as we sort of work into the future from a business perspective as well, what are some of the key human skills that we'll need to develop or at least focus a bit more attention on?
Look, you know, as we like to say, you know, if you can replicate it, we'll automate it. So the things that aren't easily replicable that take individual response and individual judgment. So if they're not cookie cutter things, so things like communication will be always important. It always has been important. So you know, can you relate to people? Can you understand them? Empathy is always going to be important. Building team, being able to transfer information clearly, quickly, easily, so people can understand it, and creativity skills. So, how do you problem solve? How do you come up with a new way of doing things? How do you have an insight to, you know, how do you make that data meaningful? So again, we can capture data en masse, but we can't necessarily interpret it and make it useful. Data without meaning is, you know, just numbers, really. It's sort of the interpretation that makes it useful. So that will be really important. And then, you know, it's always still going to be, can you look after yourself? Can you get stuff done? Can you make things happen? Can you get out of bed in the morning and go and achieve something? Will you get, you know, sucked into your Candy Crush app on your phone? Yeah, that's it. Still, those distinctions will still be really important, and we think we're going to need more of them, if anything. Because you won't be able to just show up to work and input some data and do a really repetitive job. You'll have to do more than that.
Yeah. Now, I did notice when I was doing a little LinkedIn stalking in preparation for today's interview that there's you're involved with something called the Impossible Institute. You, with your background, of course, I'm hooked. You've got me. Can you tell me a little bit more about what the Impossible Institute is?
Well, it's a training and development company. So we help organisations, big and small, learn to think differently, to do change differently, and, you know, to just change what's possible for themselves, their company. We like to teach a lot of skills and a lot of thinking. So it's a really fun sort of education training company.
Yeah, what's one of the biggest roadblocks or barriers at the moment with the C-suite in change?
Oh, look, I think just the constant rate of change. Mm. And human beings, we're wired not to change. So obviously we physically change, but emotionally and physiologically our brains particularly are wired to repeat. It's made us incredibly successful as a species. We've been, you know, we're pattern-making machines, and to endure constant change, not get to a reset and forget. So, you know, we go, okay, it's okay, it's a big change, and we reset. But at the moment, we're not being given that opportunity. It's just constant. And I think the C-suite, everyone's over it. You know, change fatigue is a thing. Mm. People are just exhausted. The word change almost is just, people are numb to it, and we hear a lot of that. They just go, oh, they roll their eyes. Oh, it's another change program running through. It's another change system. It's an, oh, we've seen it all before. I think that is the biggest challenge we face, is change isn't going away, yet people are sick to death of it already.
Yeah, so when you do your speaking, I notice you do quite a bit of motivational speaking. Is there any particular topic that's most requested?
Change. How do we do change better?
Yeah, okay. Of course. I actually walked straight into that one, didn't I?
You did. It was like a trap.
It was. I trapped myself. Okay.
Yeah. At the moment, literally every briefing call, so you get a briefing call beforehand, you know, make sure you understand the audience. And literally if I had money for every time I get on a call, and they go, so our industry is facing a lot of change right now.
Right.
But it's the truth. And, you know, you have to laugh in a way, but it just absolutely, and that's what's terrifying us as parents. I've got a 10-year-old, and it's just such a common question, is we can't see 10 years out, really. You know, we can guess, but we can't truly see that far. And we know that the rate of change, our friend Anders Sormann-Nielsen's is a speaker, and he had a great quote the other week, which was, change is really fast, but it's the slowest it's ever going to be again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Good. Interesting.
Really, yeah, very thought-provoking. Yeah. And on that note, if you're wanting to future-proof yourself and your team and your kids, have a read of Forever Skills by Kieran Flanagan and Dan Gregory. And I'm assuming it's available where all great books are sold.
It is. I know bookshops are disappearing,
yes,
sadly. But, yes, in bookshops and obviously online at your booksellers.
And if people want to continue the conversation with you, Kieran, they can find you on Twitter, they can find you on Facebook under the Impossible Institute. I'll certainly be following you, and also on LinkedIn. Thank you once again for your valuable time and helping all business owners, business leaders, entrepreneurs, startups, anyone else that has got a business thought, help them future-proof themselves, their team and their kids. Thanks, Kieran.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. We enjoy picking these brains here on Taking Care of Business, and we'll be right back with some more brain picking right after this. That's the end of another stimulating show. We hope you've enjoyed eavesdropping on our conversation, picked up some tips, learned something new, or at the very least feel inspired. If you just joined us, you've missed a lot, but the podcast will be available on my social media, Jackie Mitchell. Thank you to our worldly and thought-provoking guests. We look forward to your company next Friday. In the meantime, keep taking care of your business mindset.